Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast and of course to SavvyDentist.com. It is great to have you here again this week for another episode of our show. And my guest today is someone who I regard as an entrepreneur's entrepreneur. John Warrilow has started, grown and sold several businesses. Now, in addition to doing all of that, he's the author of three best-selling books. The first of these books is a book that was very near and dear to my heart many years ago and remains so, and that is called Built to Sell. And that book really explores what it takes to create a business of value, one that can thrive without you. His second book was called The Automatic Customer, and that explores creating a recurring revenue business, irrespective of the industry you're in. And his third and most recent book is called The Art of Selling Your Business. And of course, we're going to dive into a lot of that material today. John is the host of Built to Sell Radio, and his work has been featured in a huge number of publications around the world, including Inc., Forbes, to name just a few. You can check out his work at builttosell.com. And of course, if you want to get a couple of goodies, head across to builttosell.com/selling. And there's lots of free gifts on that little page there for you. So John, welcome to the show. And thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us.
Oh my gosh. It's great to be with you, Jesse.
Well, I have been a fan of your work for a long time now. And as I said in our off-air conversation, Built to Sell was a book that actually really changed my world. It was a business book that opened my eyes to understanding a model, understanding a niche, really getting out of the day-to-day operations. And in fact, little fun fact here for you, John, is this is going to sound a little bit random, but I'll share it with you nonetheless, is the size of your book, Built to Sell, when I was writing my own book and I was trying to think of the layout and the size of it, I got the ruler out across Built to Sell because I wanted the dimensions to be the same as yours. So that's where it comes from.
Oh, that's funny. How did you apply it to the dental practice industry? What did you see as the transferable lessons?
Well, I really thought about owning the process. In the book, the graphic designer, whose name was Alex from memory, he really had that general graphic design business and he decided that he wanted to niche down on logos and he built that process around that. And so really what I looked at from that perspective, I looked at it from two different perspectives actually. I looked at it from the perspective of our dental practice and creating a process that we could own, that we could deliver upon, and of course that we could market. And that's certainly been part of what we do. The simple fact of the matter is that what I've experienced anyway is that process in my world was nothing particularly unique, but we were able to own that space. Probably like a logo design process is quite standard in many aspects, but you add your own salt and pepper to it. But equally in this business, my consulting business, I took exactly the same concept and I developed my own method and knowledge around that. And so that's been a really interesting and valuable point. So again, thank you so much for taking the time to write the book. It's been a wonderful read.
Oh, that's great. I'm thrilled to hear its applicability to dental practices because the message is very much resonant with service businesses, ones where there aren't oftentimes a lot of assets to sell at the end of the day. Maybe you own your building, but very few hard assets necessarily. Yet the value, of course, is in the profitability of the practice. And so making sure that exists without the owner is key. But I'm glad that you were able to apply it to dentistry.
Oh, thank you. John, I heard an interesting stat the other day, and I don't know if this is an accurate stat but I'm happy for you to correct me. I read a stat the other day that somewhere around 50% or less of businesses that are ever started ultimately get sold. And that got me thinking. And I was thinking about the fact that for every business, there's kind of one of two outcomes. Either it gets sold eventually or it closes down. And I wanted to ask you, firstly, what is the real stat there? I don't know if that's a hard stat or an accurate stat. But if that stat is remotely accurate, why is it that so many businesses never get to the point of being sold?
Yeah, I think the stat I've seen for North America is that 50% of businesses never celebrate their fifth birthday, meaning they go out of business. And that may be akin to similarly that they don't ever sell. Most of them, of course, go out of business for lots of reasons, lack of capital, they miss the idea, et cetera. I'd imagine the dental practice is just because of the difficulty of getting into a dental practice would be much lower. I would imagine most dental practices are successful. They're run by obviously very smart individuals and there's a lot of capital that goes into them. So I would imagine that they achieve that. But I would also agree that a lot probably shut down without selling. And usually that's because effectively they're set up, although they are legally incorporated businesses generally, they're effectively set up as jobs for the dentist themselves. And so when the dentist wants to leave, there's nothing really to transfer other than maybe the chairs and a little bit of equipment. That's the downside of building a business that's dependent on you as a practitioner, right? There's no transferability. When you think about it, an acquirer looking at the business will just say, well, there's nothing really there. And maybe you could say, well, there's a customer list or a patient list. And yeah, to some extent that might be true. But if the loyalty accrues to you as a dentist, then that customer list is of questionable value. So there's a lot of problems with being in the center point of your dental practice. And that's really what the book is about, is how do you transfer an owner-operated business, one where the owner is the practitioner, to a company that can thrive without the owner. And that's really the ultimate, right? Because you could sell, but you don't have to sell at that point. You could create some passive income. You could bring in a junior dentist and hive off some of the profits, et cetera. You've got options at that point.
It's a really interesting conversation. And obviously in your value builder system, you talk about eight factors that really create enterprise value. And I know we are going to talk about exiting, but I guess if we're going to think about exiting, we want to obviously have a business that has value in the marketplace as well. And as you quite rightly point out, we want to always build it to sell and have the choice of whether we do, whether we don't, when we do, when we don't, and so on and so forth. So before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of an elegant exit, I'm wondering if you can just walk me through a couple of those parts of the value builder system that you think are going to be really relevant to dental practices. You've already touched on that key person dependency, which is huge in the work that we do. You know, a lot of the work we do is about trying to minimize that. And of course, yeah, when you minimize that, you minimize risk and so on. But what else do you see as the key drivers of enterprise value within, I suppose, a boutique practice like that or a service-based industry? And of course, that's going to be the same in dentistry as it might be for a medical practice or an accountancy firm or even a legal firm. What sort of things do you see?
Yeah, look, I mean, let's be clear. Financial performance of the dental practice, top line turnover, yep, revenue, and bottom line profit is going to be essential. Think of a valuation. I'm going to distill valuation down to valuation consultants would cringe at me saying this, but essentially you could think of valuation as what multiple, yeah, of your profit is a buyer willing to pay. And so there's two numbers you can manipulate there. One is, yeah, your profit and the other is your multiple. Yeah. Most dentists will say, great, I can jack up my profit, and they'll spend all their time, how do I lower my cost of goods and how do I increase my rates and can I nudge up my cost for a filling from five, you know, whatever. That, I think, is one approach. The other approach is to really focus on the multiple itself.
Yeah.
And the multiple is determined by the drivers that you reference. So one of them, obviously, is going to be key person dependency. We call it hub and spoke. But effectively, how well your business would perform without you doing the work. That's a big driver. Another one that may be a little bit less intuitive, and particularly in the dental practice space, would be monopoly control, wherein, and Warren Buffett talks a lot about this, talks about the idea that he invests in businesses with a competitive moat around them. And when he gets asked, like, what do you mean by a competitive moat? It's basically your competitive protection. And when you've got a thick and wide competitive protection, that enables you to have pricing authority to some extent. You can charge what you want, and therefore you overall build a more profitable business. Now, when you come back to, well, how do you create a competitive moat? On one hand, it's some sort of invention. It's pretty rare in a dental practice to have something, sure, totally unique. But the other piece is marketing. How well you distinguish or differentiate your dental practice from the one down the street. Everybody thinks they know what a dentist does, I think. You can tell me if I'm wrong. But if you create a point of differentiation that makes your practice unique, and a certain way you serve customers or a certain way you approach the experience, and you codify that, you trademark that, you build that as your defining or distinct competitive advantage, that becomes a competitive moat. And I think that's another of one of the other eight drivers that I think, again, in a dental practice is probably not the most intuitive, but I think it could actually play a significant role in the value of a dental practice.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting that you talk about the competitive moat, because I agree marketing is a huge part of that. What we've also seen with some of the other practices, particularly more regional areas, they've created this situation of geographic dominance, and they might have a regional town, and around that town, there's satellites. And so what they do is they'll have almost like a hub and spoke practice structure in a sense. And I don't want to use it in the same context that you're talking about, where you'll have your main practice in the middle, and there'll be a practice in all these satellite towns. So for anyone driving through any one of these towns, they have to go past one of their shops, basically. And so they create this large drawing pool. And so we've seen that work as well, but that's probably a little more related to the regional areas. So we've spoken briefly about some of those drivers that do create value. And I wanted to just kind of shift gears and think about the main topic, which we're going to be talking about today, which is exiting businesses. And I shared with you a few things off air about the business that I've exited. You've obviously exited businesses and so on and so forth. And so what I wanted to ask you is, I guess most of us at some point in our business journey sit there wondering what our business is worth, probably do the mental calculations, do our own little version of a balance sheet, probably jack up the inflate the value a little bit in my own mind as it is. Yeah. But I wanted to ask you, how do you know when the right time to exit is? Is there a sense of knowing within the owner that you've seen, because you've spoken to lots of people in this space, do they kind of get to this place of going, I just know within myself it's time? Or is there a tap on the shoulder? Or is there some sort of calamity? What's typically the trigger point for thinking about selling?
Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of entrepreneurs, this is one that we get wrong. Oftentimes what I hear is entrepreneurs are trying to time their exit, meaning they're trying to kind of sell when the market's at a peak and interest rates are, you know, as low as they possibly can be, and we've just had our best year ever and we're going to sell. And of course, that's great. Nobody I know is that good at predicting the future. But realistically, when you sell a business, it's a little bit more, we think of it oftentimes as owners as like a 4x100 meter relay, right? Like you pass the baton to the next guy. Reality is that there's usually a longer transition period where you might be in an earnout situation where you've got to stay on for a couple of years. And oftentimes we sell too late. So we think, oh, I want to be on the beach when I'm 60. And so 59th birthday comes and says, okay, it's time. The reality is, though, you're going to have to be on some sort of transition period. So you've got to move up your sell-by date for the average earnout. I'm not sure what it is in dental practices. In the US, it's 3 years across all industries. Mm. Is it something similar in dental practices?
It can be up to 5 here in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you want to be on the beach by your time you're 60, you've really got to execute the transaction at 55. Yep. You want to back that up by a year to really properly market your business. I think you want probably a year to do it properly. And that's when your business is ready to go to market. So now you're 54 when you're ready to go to market. Now there's a period of time where you really want to focus on making the business as valuable as you can by getting yourself out of the operation. So it takes a long time, much longer than most people think about. The other thing I think we run the risk of, again, as business owners, is we what we call ride it over the top, meaning we always think our best days ahead of us, right? As entrepreneurs, we're optimistic by nature. And the problem with that, of course, is that we run the risk of effectively kicking a gift horse in the mouth. I'm reminded of a story outside of dental practice, but I think you'll get the gist of it. It's a guy named Rand Fishkin who built a software company, built it up to $5 million in revenue when he got a call from a guy named Brian Halligan, who was the head of HubSpot at the time. Yeah. It's an all-in-one email marketing software. He made an offer to Halligan of $25 million for cash and stock in HubSpot. And Rand Fishkin said no, because at the time he thought his business was worth more. And instead he raised venture capital. The venture capitalists came in, they changed the business. They in fact started to get into lots of different product lines. After time, Rand was removed as the CEO of his company. And I interviewed him on Built to Sell Radio and I said, what was that like? How did it feel? And he, you know, obviously it was a gut punch. And I said, what are your shares in Mosworth today, given the fact the VCs have come and they've made all these changes? And he said, they're probably not worth anything. And I was like, what do you mean anything? And he said, well, because they've got a preferred return in their deal, meaning they get all their money out with interest and a preferred return after the fact, before he sees anything as a common shareholder. And I said, what was that offer of HubSpot worth today, given the appreciation of HubSpot stock? And he said, John, it would be close to $200 million.
Oh my God, that's
a wild example. But in a dental practice, like in a good year, maybe a dental practice trades at 5x EBIT. In a bad year, it probably trades at 4.
Yep.
In a fantastic year, maybe 5.5. Trying to time the sale of your dental practice based on where you are in the economic cycle, I think is a fool's errand, because effectively you have to then go take that money and do something with it, right? Yeah. And if the stock market is inflated because the price for dental practices is also inflated, you're just selling into or buying into a equally inflated asset class. So look, I don't think trying to time the sale of your business makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, perfect. I wanted to ask you a little bit about people kind of running out of puff and selling their business because they're just exhausted.
Yeah.
Have you interviewed any people or come across people who have just kind of gone, you know what, I'm burnt out, I'm struggling, I've invested all of my energy into this and then some, and now I really just want to go and sit by the beach. And the reason I ask this question is because that's what I did. I burnt myself out, I hit the brick wall. And really, in my case, I came to regret that sale because really what I needed was a really good holiday rather than selling my business. Have you seen many examples of that?
Yeah, I definitely think we have seen lots of stories where the owner is exhausted. And I think it can be physically exhausted. In a dental practice, I'd imagine it would be physically exhausted at times. I often see more mental exhaustion, however. I think I interviewed Tim Ferriss, the guy who wrote The 4-Hour Workweek, and I said, what caused you to sell this business, even though it was only 4 hours a week? I mean, it's incredible. Like, it's a goose that laid the golden egg or whatever. And he said, yeah, but here's the thing. Running a company, even though I wasn't doing the work anymore, it was always running through my mind. Mm. And it was like he described it as antivirus software running on the CPU of his brain. Yeah. It just slows the entire operation down, right? Like, you're always in the back of your mind grinding, you know, that latest business problem. And so I think that's a good analogy for what becomes just a really grinding experience. I'm reminded of another guy. And this may resonate more with dentists, because I know there's a lot of capital that goes into a dental practice. You've often got to borrow a lot of money to build it. And again, an example outside of the dental industry, but I think maybe has some relevance. It came from a guy named Joey Redner. Joey built a craft brewery in Tampa, Florida, across in the United States. Yeah. Craft beer, I know, is a big deal in Australia as well. Anyways, sure, he built it up. It's a very difficult business to get into. Lots of capital, like a dental practice. He got borrows $800,000, I think it was, from his dad, and built it up. And the first batch of beer was a huge success, sold out in all the local bars, and so much so that he had to build brewing capacity. And okay. So he's in hock to his dad for $800,000. Then he goes in and gets a bank loan for another few million dollars to build out his capacity again. And again, the beer continues to sell. He goes regionally. It's a huge success. He's on the cover of all the, you know, local newspapers and so forth. And then he runs out of brewing capacity again. And he's still in hock to his dad. He's still in hock to the bank for the second rollout. And the business says, look, if you're going to reach the demand and keep the momentum to go, you got to borrow money and expand again. And he throws his hands up in the air figuratively and just says, enough. I can't do it anymore. I feel like the gambler in the Las Vegas blackjack table who's got all those chips. He's just won like five hands in a row, and he's got all his chips, and he's being asked to go again. And he said, enough. And I think, and when I talked to Redner, he said it was just the release of the stress that came with selling was enormous. And his business was profitable. You know, it was a successful, growing business, but the mental drain of being in so much debt for so long started to take its toll. So yeah, I see physical exhaustion, but I think more often you see mental exhaustion from growing a business.
So one of the things that I want to ask you, when you've spoken to people who have successfully exited, did they have a plan for post-exit? And the other thing I would like to ask is, and again, we spoke a little bit about this off air, is if there is an earnout and you're required to stay in the business and continue to that success, you know, for a period of time, how typically do the owners handle no longer having the keys to the car, or in my case, the keys to the practice? How do owners typically transition from being the head honcho to perhaps being someone who now has to take direction from the new owners? Have you come across any issues or challenges, or in fact,
badly?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that in my case too. I was the worst employee ever. But yeah, I'm just curious.
Describe your case, because I think it's important, and your guys will appreciate hearing it, I'm sure.
Well, interestingly enough, we sold our practices going back to 2008, and we sold the practice. And towards the end of the negotiation, it turned out that there'd been a bit of an issue around business registration names, and there was a bit of argy-bargy between the two legal teams, and that spilled over to between us as the vendors and the purchasers. And it was not as happy a handover as we could have had, because that legal argument kind of spilled into our personal relationship. And so the new owners basically took the keys of the premise off me, which meant that I could not be on the practice premises unsupervised, which, having literally built the practice from the ground up, done all the legwork, knew where every bit of plumbing was, knew where everything was, it was really horrible. And then, of course, having to get permission to do this and having to get permission to do that, I found that I felt a stranger in my own business. And it was weird. It was like walking into your home, but having a different family there.
That's a great analogy. I've never heard that before.
It was weird. And so I walked in and nothing felt familiar. The vibe changed. And of course, you're trying to put on the best face you can for the sure. customers and all that sort of stuff. But it was pretty tough. And so we negotiated an earlier exit for me than anticipated. And I think they were as relieved about that as I was. And look, they've gone on to take that practice to great success and have done well with it, and that's awesome. But that particular period of time was quite uncomfortable, I'd have to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Your experience is not unique. We did some research recently and identified that 1 year after selling their business, 74% of business owners end up regretting the decision to sell.
Wow.
That is a catastrophic number. And so we unpacked it and tried to figure out what was driving the dissatisfaction. And there are four factors that we identified. The first of which is that they were all push and no pull. What do I mean by push versus pull? So push factors are the things that frustrate you about your dental practice. Insurance, red tape, patients who don't do as they told, dental hygienists who don't show up for work, like all that stuff are push factors, right? And they're frustrations for running a practice. Pull factors are the things you want to go do next. And most of us forget to think about the pull factors. Mm. What's exciting? What do we want? Do we want to write a book, start a consultancy, get involved in a charity, whatever? We think, oh, well, when we sell, we'll figure all that out. And that's a recipe for disaster. I'm reminded of a story, again, a story outside of dental, but I think it's germane to our conversation. Came from a guy named Sean Oshman. Sean is a guy who was in the city of Denver, Colorado, which is like the landlocked part of the United States, no water anywhere. And on his 39th birthday, he decided he wanted to live on a sailboat. Right. So obviously he would have to sell his business. It was a little IT consulting business, a couple million in revenue. And Sean goes to a business broker. Broker comes back with an offer of 2.6 times SDE, seller's discretionary earnings, which is like kind of a version of profit.
Yep.
And Oshman takes the offer. And I interviewed him after the sale. And I said, you know, it's 2.6 times for a small company. It's not like, it's not horrible. It's not, it's kind of average, right? For a small, IT. How do you feel about that? And he says, I'm happy as a clam. And I'm like, but it's only 2.8. And he said, yeah, but John, you're missing the point. I live on a sailboat. and I've always remembered that story, because for me, it's indicative of this first of the four factors that people end up regretting, is they don't think of their pull factors. For Sean, it was living life on a sailboat. And he left that business with no regret because he had something he wanted to go do. And so I think that's one of the biggest mistakes we make is we think, oh, you know, it'd be so great to be rid of all these frustrations, but we're not clear on what the pull factors are.
Well, that was certainly the case for me as well. I had a lot of push factors and not a lot of pull factors. And I got to the other side of the sale. And by the time I'd had a holiday and kind of rejuvenated myself, all I could think of was, wow, I sold a good income stream. And then I was without that. Yes, I had a pot of money in the bank, but I remember thinking, I don't know that I would make that decision again with the benefit of hindsight.
Well, that's, in fact, it's funny you should mention that. It's the second of the four reasons is, and it doesn't sound exactly the same in your case, but the second of the four reasons people regret their decision to sell is they wake up one day, usually a year or two after, and think, oh man, did I leave money on the table?
Yeah.
And they wonder, did I maybe not do as well as I could have or should have? And that's usually the case when you don't create some degree of competitive tension for your company. In other words, if you sell to one buyer in a negotiated sale where there's no other acquirer at the table, that can oftentimes lead to regret because there is no market for a dental practice, right? There is rumor and innuendo, and you go to an industry event, somebody got five times, another guy got five, but you don't actually know until you actually sell. And so that's why I'm a big fan of trying to get a second offer. For the larger practices listening to this, they might be able to attract a private equity offer. You never know. There may be other options. Clearly, there's different ways to transition a dental practice. But if you can get a second offer, I think it just gives you some sense that you're getting a fair offer. It doesn't have to be like an outlandish offer, but at least a fair offer, I think, is important.
It's really interesting. I'd like to talk about generating extra offers and additional interest in the business. And of course, one of the things that comes up when people decide that they do want to sell their dental practice, they're intensely worried that their patients are going to find out. They're intensely worried that their staff are going to find out. And they've spent so much time in trying to build a team, build the patient base, do all those sorts of things. To then shop it around, so to speak, they worry about the non-disclosure and the privacy of all those things being broken. So I guess that's a double-barreled question, but how do you ameliorate the concerns around privacy? I'm sure that comes up all the time. Of course, there'll be agreements, but beyond that. And then secondly, how do you create that competitive bidding process? What does that look like? Is it going through a broker and asking them to do that work for you? What's the practicalities, please, John?
Yeah. So we lay out a process in the book that describes how you do that. It involves a teaser and an NDA that's only signed once they've sort of gotten excited about the practice. So there is a way that you can minimize the likelihood that the word gets out among your customers and patients and so forth. Having said that, no system is completely foolproof. And the wider you go to the marketplace, the more likely that either key supplier or patient will find out. I'm reminded of, and so I think you have to somehow balance your need to get a fair price and your need to get multiple offers with the reality that the more people you go to, the more chances it'll get out. And so, look, I think if you have one or two people in mind who you think will want to make an offer, then maybe you can keep the list of people to a very small list. I'm reminded of a story, again, not in the dental practice, but it'll serve to communicate the point. A guy's name is Peter Kelly. And Peter built a company that basically did auctions for used cars. Obviously, we have websites now where we can buy a car. He built it for used car dealers to buy their inventory. It was called Open Lane. It was only available to used car dealers. And there they could look up a car and they could decide whether to bid on it or not. At the time, the alternative was these old school physical auctions where they sold used cars. And they would go by on these massive conveyor belts. And the used car dealer would have like 8 seconds to decide which one they wanted. It was a terrible business model. But he built this business up and built it up very successfully. Along the way, he got interest from the three big old school auctioneers, right? Wanting to remake and, you know, modernize their company. And each time he turned them down. But he lived with this little nagging feeling in his mind, which was that if the original equipment manufacturers, the car companies, BMW, Ford, whatever, if they ever found out how lucrative his business is, they just go into business and create their own auction sites, right? Because a Ford dealer is going to want to buy Ford cars. Yep. And if he ever got wind of what he had created, they would put him out of business overnight. And so when he went to sell, he was worried about the same thing you're describing, which is customer suppliers finding out. And so he went to the three auction houses and said, all right, you've expressed interest in the past. Now's your time. On this day, I'm going to be accepting an offer to sell my business. And please prepare your letter of intent. All three made an offer and he sold his business for a very, very good multiple. But that was a luxury he had because he knew that those three would be interested. Mm. He didn't have to go to a more broad scale auction because he was deathly fearful that in this case, the other competitors would find out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess if we were to look at a scenario where there's not that luxury of having people already expressed an interest, and let's just say it goes out and there is some feedback or interest that comes back through a broker or otherwise, obviously the negotiations begin after that. Negotiation is a skill that no one teaches us in dental school. It's not something that is in the curriculum, you'll be surprised to know. Dealing with difficult patients, dealing with non-compliant children, absolutely. Yeah. So maybe there's some negotiation in that.
Sure.
But you never really win so much with a non-compliant child. But I wanted to ask you, when it comes to negotiation, I know that there's no one-size-fits-all strategy or hints and tips or seven secret hacks to a great negotiation. But I guess thinking about the fundamentals or the principles that surround a good negotiation, what are the key things that I think people should be looking for as they go through that negotiation process? What are the pitfalls? What are the things they should be trying to achieve? How to achieve that outcome?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a ton, and in many cases, there's a whole section of the book, which is kind of hacks and sort of negotiation tips. I'll give you a couple. You know, one is that a savvy buyer is going to want to know what you want for your dental practice. They're going to try to kind of tease that out of you. And oftentimes it's done when your defenses are down. Many of these deals are sort of executed by an M&A advisor, a business broker. And the buyer will kind of work to lower your defenses, build their own relationship independent of your broker. And, you know, you may be over a pint of beer or over a coffee and they'll say, you know, like, what do you think's fair? Like, have you given any thought to what you want for your business? And by that time, you sort of built this rapport and the question seems so innocuous, like, yeah, sure. And it's almost always a mistake to answer that question because on the high end, if you throw out some outlandish number, like I want 15 times EBITDA for my, you know, the likelihood that that buyer is going to walk away and say, wow, Jesse's crazy is very high. Yep. Equally, if you put something more reasonable on the table, you're probably putting a ceiling onto which you will never sell your business for above. And so what I think you want to do is try to get the buyer to make some sort of gesture or some sort of offer first. And you may be surprised pleasantly at what that number is. At the very least, you're not making the mistake of going first. I think that's one of the most sort of classic mistakes, if you will. Another one that we see a lot, and it goes back to your personal situation, Jesse, is this sort of, you get to the end of the road and you're burnt out.
Yeah.
And every owner is going to, every potential buyer is going to say, Jesse, why do you want to sell? It looks like a great practice. You got a great location. You got all these loyal patients. I mean, why would you ever want to sell this thing? And that is a very calculated question because if you answer and says, God, I'm just burnt out. Like I need a break. I need a vacation. What does that communicate to the buyer? It communicates that underneath the water, your feet are just going like crazy, like the duck, you know, and it's exhausting to run this practice. And that's exactly the wrong thing that buyer needs to hear. So there's a right way, I think, to answer that question and a very wrong way to answer it. And that's another kind of trick buyers will use to try to get the straight goods.
Interesting that we talk about that, which kind of comes back to what we spoke about earlier in the conversation about the build to sell. When we sold that business and I started a different business because I didn't have the pull factors at the time, it was only then I realized with a big face palm that I really should have reorganized my business differently. And I realized after the fact how I could have made that a much better business to sell. And of course, we now run our second practice much different to that. But I want to come back to that question of, you know, what do you think is a reasonable price for your business? Because you're absolutely right. It's going to be over a pint of beer. It's going to be over in a very relaxed, casual conversation. And I know that you don't want to necessarily give it away. But sometimes when that question comes at you in such a direct manner, there's a bit of a, almost like a deer in the headlights kind of moment where you're kind of going, I know I shouldn't be answering this question, but how do I deflect it elegantly without giving it away? And would you just suggest referring it back to the business broker or whoever it is handling that sale? Is that the best strategy?
Yeah, absolutely. I just did an interview with a guy's name is Adi Pinar out of South Africa, and he was represented by an M&A professional. And the M&A professional said, you talk to all the buyers, you answer any question they ask you. The only question you are forbidden to answer is, what do you want for your company? That you defer and refer to me. So yeah, I think you can by all means defer that to your broker. I think you can also say, you know, look, I'm a reasonable person. I'd be happy to entertain any reasonable offer you thought made sense.
Yeah.
And basically put it back on them. The other nuance here, and this gets into some of the mechanics and weeds of selling a company, is oftentimes people will throw out a number like, oh, you know, we want 5x EBITDA. Okay. Fair enough. So let me just unpack that. Is that 5x trailing 12 months EBITDA, which would be 12 months up until today, the previous 12 months? Or is it a weighted average of the last 3 years? Or is it future EBITDA? Is it adjusted EBITDA? Or like all of these things are different. I'll give you an example. Another example from outside dental, but I think it'll serve the purpose. Ari Aukerman built a beautiful little company called Bunk One. It was a very rudimentary software company that allows parents to send notes to their kids. And Ari was approached to buy his company. And they went through a whole negotiation. And the private equity company that was buying his business said, look, we can't pay, I think it was 7x EBITDA by memory. Doesn't really matter to the point that we can't pay a penny more than 7x EBITDA. And Ari looks at the profitability of the company and times seven, and he's like, it's not enough for the life of work that he's put together. And he's about to walk away. And then his advisor says, well, hold on a second. Let's go through the adjustments process. Let's go through and restate or recast your profitability based on what it would look like for that private equity group. And they went through what's called the adjustments process, which is basically removing a lot of your one-time expenses, any things that you run through your dental practice that aren't really business expenses. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell anybody. You know, like the vacation that you characterize as a conference, the car, you know, all that stuff.
I have no idea what you're talking about, John. Yeah,
no idea.
Foreign exactly. Concept to me.
Yeah, exactly. You take all that stuff out. And by doing that, you're improving with each thing you take out your profitability.
Yeah.
And that's called adjustments. And effectively, you're increasing your profitability. So in the case of Ari Aukerman, by the time he got through the adjustments process, it was a much larger number that seven was multiplying. And so the overall equation worked out for him, and he sold his business in a very successful transaction. Now owns part of a professional baseball team in the United States. But
wow.
It worked out really, really well. But it wouldn't have had he just kind of, again, myopically focused on a multiple of earnings, because that can be quite dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, one of the things that comes out of that as well, which we've kind of touched on a little bit, and we've spoken about around the edges a little bit, is about the earn-out period. Because if you've got a dental practice that's doing several million dollars, somewhere between $4 to $10 million, the pool of private buyers is going to be diminished. You're more likely to be selling to one of the corporates, or if on the larger scale, maybe private equity. And there'll almost certainly be an earn-out period around that. And of course, no one likes the earn-out. I mean, everyone kind of wants the money and wants to run, basically.
Yeah.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you whether there was anything, particularly while we talk about negotiation, to either reducing or eliminating that earn-out so that we can, is it taking a lower offer up front, or what does that look like? I'm sure you've had lots of people successfully negotiate no earn-out. So how do you ameliorate that?
Yeah, look, I think we have to first understand, first of all, for those who don't know an earn-out, let me just define it. Basically, you accept a value for your company, the buyer pays a portion of it up front, and then puts part of it, quote, at risk in the future if you achieve a certain goal in the future. And usually that's profitability of your firm or practice as a division of a larger practice. Yeah. And that's an earn-out. And if we look at why they happen, oftentimes they happen for two reasons. One, the buyer and the seller just can't come to terms on the price. Mm-hmm. And when there's a huge gap between the buyer and the seller, oftentimes an earnout will be used to say, the buyer will say, well, look, we're happy to pay that oversized valuation for your company, but you're going to have to earn out a portion of that.
Yep.
The other reason that happens is owner dependency, right? Where you've got a dental practice where all the patients love XYZ dentist, and the buyer is really worried about transferring that relationship equity over to them. And so that's the second reason. I think obviously in the case of a dental practice, that many dentists are going to be more susceptible to the latter, the second example.
Yeah.
I think the more you can demonstrate to a buyer that the firm and the practice does not depend on you personally. Mm-hmm. So that comes down to basically how many hours are you working in the, how many billable hours are you working in the practice? If it's low, your chances of having a significant portion in earnout is low in as well. Equally, if it's high, then expect an earnout. I think you could also tie your earnout to something other than earnings. The problem with earnings, profit, is that once your business, as you found out in the most sort of stark way, becomes a division of someone else's company or someone else effectively owns it, you no longer control it. And you no longer control the bookkeeping or the finances of the business. And as a result, things can go wrong with the bookkeeping that will make it difficult for you to hit your earnout.
Yeah.
And so I like the idea of patient retention.
Yeah.
Potentially as a way to model an earnout. I mean, the job I think is to maximize your cash up front and minimize your earnout. Yeah. I think most dental practices probably sell with some earnout, but if you can tie it to something other than earnings, I think you'd be better served.
Yeah. In fact, what happens a lot, I should say, is there's usually, rather than earn out in terms of earning money as you go, it's almost like a clawback. So you'll get your cash up front, but if you don't meet the targets, then you're on the hook for the clawback, which is, I guess, a reverse earn out in a way anyway. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned my favorite topic, actually. I don't know if you know this, Johnny, or you probably don't, but you mentioned patient retention. That is, you know, the book I told you about that I measured the same as Built to Sell?
Yeah, it was
called Retention. So we've just now closed the loop on that. So we can go from there. So I think when it comes to all of these factors, John, there's a lot that goes into preparing for the exit, executing the exit, and then, of course, creating a really rich and meaningful life after the exit. Yeah. And you've been through that process several times yourself. I've been through it once myself. And I can tell you very categorically there are things that I did, you know, really, really incorrectly and things I would not do the same again. Just as we come to the conclusion of our conversation today, I guess if we could get the gospel according to John when it comes to the art of selling your business, if we're going to put it on a billboard or on a bit of a bumper sticker, what would be the key pearls of wisdom you'd leave the audience with as we go through this?
Well, first of all, figure out your pull factors, and we've talked about that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, attracting multiple offers gives you the ability to punch above your weight. It's very hard to bluff in a transaction when you're dealing with one other buyer.
Yeah.
And so if you can create multiple offers, that's good. Having a what they refer to in negotiation three as a BATNA, a best alternative to a negotiated agreement. In other words, the willingness in most cases to continue to operate your dental practice. So doing it, and this ties up to something we talked about earlier, doing it much earlier than feels natural. Because if you are exhausted and burnt out and on the verge of, you know, milestone birthday, it just puts you in a very difficult position relative to if you do it early and are continue to be happy to run your company and your practice years later. It gives you that BATNA, which allows you to, again, punch above your weight when it comes to negotiation.
Oh, fantastic. John, we have covered a fair bit of territory today. And as I said at the outset, I've been a fan of all your books, Built to Sell, Automatic Customer, The Art of Exiting or Art of Selling Your Business. Fantastic reads. It's almost like the Star Wars trilogy. You've kind of got to get all three of them. I don't know which character you'd have in there, probably Obi-Wan Kenobi or something like that. But you know, when it comes to that entrepreneurial journey, you know, you've really provided a wonderful pathway for people to follow. So I want to say thank you to you for shining the light down that pathway for people to be able to see where they're going. Ladies and gents, again, just one more time, that website I'd encourage you to head across to is builttosell.com. And of course, head across to builttosell.com/selling for some gifts around the book, etc. But do grab all three books. They're all incredible reads. And I think you should read them all from beginning to end, probably in order, but depending on where you're up to in your own journey, you know, you can choose that yourself. But John, thank you so much for taking the time today. You've been a wonderful guest. And as I said, I've been a fan of your work for a long time. So it's been a real pleasure to finally get to talk to you.
Thanks, Jesse. It was great to be with you.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/Savvy Dentist.